Okay, so as someone who enjoyed The Killing Game, I'm curious what you thought of The Killing Game Part 2. Did it meet all your expectations? Did it exceed them? Were you disappointed? What the hell did you think of it?
I mean, this is a very loaded question, you know, especially as somebody who enjoyed The Killing Game, you know, it's as somebody who likes blood sausage, how do you feel about it? You're diminishing me by my love for The Killing Game, I have to say. But I feel about The Killing Game Part 2 the way you feel about Killing Game Part 1.
Interesting. So you don't think it lived up to the expectations that The Killing Game put down?
This was everything that I expected to happen. You know, stuff would blow up. They would come to a decision. You know, everything would be... You know, it just all of the guns that were put on the wall in the first episode were fired. It was very satisfying. I guess... The more I see the Herosians, the less I like them. And now I'm really kind of, I don't know, they started off from something that had some interest to them. And by this point, I'm hoping to see them go now.
It's interesting, right? Because I know that we had talked a little bit last week about how the Herosian were kind of ill-conceived in a way or not really well planned, which is weird considering that they had this very, very quick arc for them where they appeared in Message in a Bottle very briefly, then they appeared in both Hunters and Prey, and now they have their own two-parter where they take over Voyager for a while. I think they said it was like 3 weeks or something. And I'm with you. Like, I don't think that there's a lot to the Herosian. I think there could be, but The Killing Game Part 2, as you said, just really... It just meets all the expectations. It doesn't really do anything surprising, and it's not really illuminating in any way. It very much feels like a Star Trek episode that someone could write. Like, if you ask someone to write a stereotypical Star Trek episode,
you're one of those people who is all like,
kind of be it.
You get a neural net to write a Voyager episode. You have this.
I think that's a good way to put it, because nothing really exciting happens. I mean, certainly it's entertaining. Certainly it's well done. You know, as I've said before in the past, one of the things that I think is very, I don't want to use the word impressive necessarily, but it's interesting that Berman era Star Trek at this point, considering it's been running for 10 years at this point. I mean, we're in 1997 now, or 1998 even.
Yeah.
It knows what it's doing. There is a baseline level of competence in terms of the production, the writing. You know, I don't think that Voyager has had, you know, a car crash episode really in a long time, but this is just vaguely unsatisfying in a way that, you know, it's like, what is the point of any of this?
Well,
and the point is to give us an episode of, an entertaining episode of television, which is fine, but...
Maybe this sounds a little unfair and a little impetuous, but this is a two-part episode in which we have a big bad being resolved. It's a costumer. It involves, you know, two different, you know, it involves several subplots. And they're doing it without breaking a sweat, and it feels kind of like, I wish they'd worked a little harder, imagine what they could do. Like this in some, I don't want to say that this feels like a lazy episode, but by this point, you're right. This has been on 10 years. They're very, very good at this. And somehow this is not enough anymore.
It's interesting, right? And I think that, you know, I'm kind of surprised by how much I'm enjoying Voyager, by how much I'm more impressed with Voyager on this watch, you know, than I have been in the past. And I think part of that is due to the fact that I am, you know, quite disappointed in Star Trek Discovery, but realizing the sort of pleasures of this style of Star Trek and the fact that I really like this style of Star Trek. This is the style of Star Trek that I grew up with and became a Star Trek fan from. And that's not to diminish the people that are coming into Star Trek through Discovery or the people that came into Star Trek through the new movies. I mean, I think all those, you know, I mean, I've heard so many stories of people watching Star Trek 09 and then going back and watching all of TOS, for instance. And I think that's great. And that's how Star Trek is going to become, you know, is going to continue to be relevant. But with an episode like The Killing Game Part 2, I'm like, would anybody watch this and become a Star Trek fan?
Yeah, it's... I don't know, because I could see, you know, if your friend who likes World War II a lot, you know, this is your gateway into Voyager for them. I don't know. I mean, again, it's a...
yeah, the four people that are super into World War II, like, and also randomly watch this episode, sure.
Well, I was about to ask, like, what about Enterprise? You didn't mention the people who got into the franchise through Enterprise, but...
I don't know if there were any, frankly, but I'm sure there were a few.
I mean, it seems like the more I'm talking about it, the more down I am on this episode, and I did like the episode. It was... very satisfying. There were a few really cool scenes in it. It's trying to do something about Nazi ideology and this alien. You know, yes, it's very clumsy, the scene where, you know, you have the one German guy who's saying, well, we need to be worried about, you know, the purity of our blood. And the Hirogen is saying he could be talking about being Hirogen. And, you know, it's very, you know, on the nose there. But, you know, that's at least what the episode is trying to do. It just seems... I don't know, smaller than it is.
No, I agree with you, because I do think that that part of the episode, while it is very on the nose and very telegraphed, it also is, I think, the part of the episode that sings the most. And
it's the most Star Trek of it.
It's the most Star Trek, but it's also the part of the episode that that feels like Joe Manosky and Brannon Braga have something to say with this.
Yeah,
because... you know, and again, I'm okay with an entertaining holodeck romp. I don't really mind them. I mean, certainly some of them are better than others. But in terms of a type of Star Trek episode that you could get in a 26-episode season, I'm not totally against them. Even though, don't go back and listen to any of our podcasts on holodeck episodes, because I'm sure that someone's going to say, ha, you hate them all. But, and maybe I do, I don't know, that could be the case. But there's just something about this that it doesn't feel like the show is trying enough. And I know we get to this point a lot with Star Trek Voyager episodes where we start talking about Star Trek Voyager as a whole, because I think that pretty much half the time, these episodes don't really have that much to sustain a critical conversation about. You know, and I think it's more interesting to examine each episode as, what does this mean for Star Trek Voyager? What is going on with this show? Why does it exist? And, you know, while TNG certainly had its share of these types of episodes, I think that there was much more of an attention to detail in TNG that is lacking in Star Trek Voyager. That, I mean, not to talk about Vis-a-Vis yet, but perfect example is the next episode where, you know, it's a Tom Paris episode. We haven't had one of those for a while. I don't remember when the last one was, but it was a while ago. And what they do with Tom Paris is go back to the well of Tom Paris is a fuck up. And is he? I don't think that's very interesting. And it really speaks to a lack of attention to detail on the show's part in terms of characterization. These characters, you know, while they are people and while they have personalities, I don't think they're very consistent, and they are much more, the characters are much more used for the whims of the plot than vice versa.
Yeah.
Which was not true for TNG.
You know, I'm thinking about why TNG did these big costumer two-parters, right? Like, they did, you know, because even something like Time's Arrow, which was, you know, a dumb episode in a lot of ways, was still a season finale, was still something that they felt important to say. And I don't know, I just keep going back to something feels a lot more mechanical about, about Killing Game. Like, This is something that they do very well. They can coordinate these sets very well. They can get all these costumes. They can get these, you know, subplots into place there. They can do this, and, you know, they can dispatch a big bad. They can do all of these things very well, but, and it feels unfair to say they don't feel ambitious about it, but, because this is certainly an ambitious episode, but I guess that you're right, that part with the, you know, when they make the connection between the Nazis and the Hirogens in the end, has the kind of most spark to it. It's kind of the part of the episode that has the most heart. That's something about something more than just, you know, these moving parts against each other, because the most of the episode is just moving parts.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. And I think that, you know, the Time's Arrow comparison is interesting because, you know, yeah, Time's Arrow is a dumb two-parter and it's a dumb episode. And it's certainly not one of my favorite two-parters in TNG. But it also does have this nice character through line of Data, you know, really confronting his mortality in a way. And that is also something that TNG, you know, that character is someone that we lived with for six seasons or five seasons before that. You know, this was a character that was very, very well sketched and well drawn. And it did, you know, the TNG characters were consistent enough, grew enough, and there was enough attention to detail amongst the relationships and the individual characters that you could elevate material like Time's Arrow by shortcutting it into a Data, you know, mortality plot, right? And The Killing Game Part 2 doesn't have any of that. I mean, I think the closest that The Killing Game 2-parter has to that is the Seven of Nine Janeway, you know, butting heads. And while that's interesting, I also don't know that the show isn't getting into a trap of repeating motifs over and over again.
And also what I would add to Time's Arrow is that what really stuck to me even beyond the Data stuff was the Guinan characterization. You know, again, that's there are two prongs of this that is on this story, and both of them are dedicated towards, you know, completing some of the character work in a fan favorite major character and a fan favorite kind of secondary character. Killing Game doesn't, you know, what other than the Seven of Nine Janeway stuff, who was this episode about? The Hirosians, and do we really care about their civilization's fate? And I think that's probably the other question of this episode. Do we care about the Hirosians' fate in this way?
I mean, I don't. I mean, I certainly don't think that I want their civilization to continue to hunt sapient species for prey. I don't want that to be the case at all. But yeah, the Hirosian are sort of, I don't know, they're kind of lazy. Like, I think they're a good concept, but the execution is very lacking. And I think your kind of criticism of this episode as being, you know, mechanistic is really interesting, because I do think that's true in a lot of ways. You know, this is a well-constructed episode. They know what they're doing. Brannon Braga and Joe Manosky can juggle all these subplots. You know, the production staff is able to find all these costumes and set up these, you know, elaborate sets. You know, the directing is fine. You know, the actors are hitting their marks. I mean, everything is good.
Yeah, this
but
isn't
the acting
an easy
is fine.
Episode to make. Yeah.
Yeah, but for what? What does it add up to? It doesn't really add up to anything. And there, I think that's what I keep going back to with Voyager, is that very rarely do these episodes, even individual episodes, sort of add up to anything. You know, there's good individual scenes, but there is a real lack of attention to detail that I keep coming back to with Voyager. And again, while I enjoyed this episode and while I enjoy Voyager, I still have to say I wish they paid attention to it more.
I think that's a perfect way to say about it. You know, the Voyager is not a bad show, but it doesn't have the, I mean, Next Generation comes up from a lot of doubt about the concept, and, you know, in the first season, it's terrible. It's a, you know, but when Next Generation finds its voice, it becomes one of the greatest shows of its decade, and, you know, one of the greatest science fiction and maybe even regular television shows. And then when you have DS9, it's the one that's very assured in its voice, that is just, that does have this massive critical hit and can say something very deep and intricate and nails that. And then you have Voyager, and it's kind of much more decadent about it, right? Like, this is, it's growing fat off its own success. It's not really taking as many creative risks as it should. And it's just kind of, it's work by this point in a way that it wasn't in Next Gen or DS9.
Yeah, I mean, I would almost say, and I don't know that I'm quite ready to back this up yet, but it almost seems like The Killing Game Part 2 is a perfect example of the show, of the franchise really coasting on its own success. You know, Deep Space Nine was there to take the big chances, and at this point it was 1998, and Deep Space Nine, you know, was not long for this world. Or maybe it was 1997, I forget. I get a little bit confused at this point. I think it was 98, because, yeah, it was 98, because Voyager ended in May of 2001. So, yes, this was 1998 by now. But still, I mean, you know, this was the sixth season of DS9. DS9 was only going to be on for another season. And I think what you're seeing, and what I think was disappointing a lot of people at the time, and in retrospect is disappointing about Star Trek Voyager, is that even when they knew that they were going into being the torchbearer of the Star Trek franchise, the foundation that they had built with the previous seasons of Voyager could not sustain that in any real way.
I mean, in some ways you can see the Star Trek shows being in competition with their predecessor, right? Like, Next Generation falters at the bit because it's trying to be much too much like TOS. And then when it kind of, you know, grows up and becomes its own thing is when it becomes good. DS9, you can see going out of its way to not be Next Generation, to find its own voice very quickly. And I guess what I'm saying is Voyager doesn't really seem to care about DS9's existence, and I wish it had more of a sibling rivalry. Again, DS9 has just gotten enough of that 6 or 8 episode arc of getting back DS9 at this point. And, you know, Voyager isn't seeing that. And, you know, Voyager's, the closest Voyager's response to that is this Hirogen arc, which was just kind of very lame compared to what we had otherwise. I know it's its own show, but again, I wish there were more of a friendly competition between the shows.
Yeah, in a certain sense. I mean, I do think that the relationship between DS9 and Voyager is interesting and kind of fraught. And, you know, I don't know to what degree they were really talking to each other. I don't know to what degree they were really interacting with each other. And, you know, we will get to Ron Moore in a little while because he did join Voyager briefly after DS9 went off the air. And we will find, I think that will say a lot about, you know, how the two shows really saw each other. Because Ron Moore was extremely dismissive of his time working for Voyager. And for his part, Brandon Braga was also extremely dismissive of Ron Moore because he felt like Ron Moore didn't really get what they were trying to do on Voyager.
Although, to be fair, on Voyager, they don't always get what they're trying to do on Voyager, so I can't blame him.
Oh, yeah, no, I think it's a sad situation all around, frankly. I think Ron Moore is a bit too dismissive on Voyager.
Yeah, yeah.
I think Brandon Braga was a bit too mean to Ron Moore, but, you know, what are you going to do about that? I mean, I don't know either of the men, and I wasn't there. But, like any good nerd, I have my opinions on it. But, you know, I don't know, to wrap back around the Killing Game, because I do feel like we should actually engage with the episode. The two big things that I think I want to talk about, A, are the Seven of Nine and,
sure,
you know, Janeway. Because I'm being a little churlish in saying that this is, once again, Janeway and Seven of Nine butting heads, because certainly that was the case in the first part of this two-parter, where they were, you know, arguing a lot, butting heads a lot, even as they thought they were other people. And I think that that was interesting because it was speaking to sort of a fundamental personality disagreement between the two of them that could not even, that could even transcend, you know, them being programmed to think they were these holodeck characters. But then the Killing Game Part 2 has them back to their old selves or back to their real selves, and they're working together.
Yeah.
And I think they work together well, actually. And I think that's really the key to it, which makes me think that the real problem with Seven of Nine and Janeway is not that they are too different, but that they are too similar.
Oh, yeah. No, that I think that is something the show is implied, but it does make complete sense for their friction. And neither Janeway nor Seven of Nine are very good to just rest and relax, right? Like, again, you know, something they have in common, but neither of them does well in downtime. They both need to be fixated on a problem, probably a scientific problem, or something difficult. They like it when they are overworked and not sleeping. And, you know, when they both have, you know, they're stuck in World War II times and the Hirogens have attacked them ship, that's a very big problem that they can distract themselves with. When it's just Seven of Nine and Janeway and they don't really have anything they're focusing on, they're going to focus on each other and they are going to attack at that point because they are, again, and it's not that they're oil and water personalities, they just maybe even see some of the own stubbornnesses that they don't like in themselves, kind of a thing.
Yeah, no, I would agree with all of that. And I think the other piece to it as well is that, you know, Voyager very quickly, you know, kind of fell into a little bit of a crunchier version of the TNG, you know, no fighting rule between the main cast. And that was always viewed as a little weird because of the Maquis stuff. But that was just how Voyager went. And what I think is interesting is that when Seven of Nine comes in, she is kind of a rogue element in the show at this point. I mean, she is not Starfleet by any sense of the imagination. She never went to Starfleet Academy. She didn't even know what Starfleet was probably until she was liberated from the Borg. And, you know, she is very much a character that is psychologically damaged, probably has some PTSD, you know, is not emotionally mature, is not mentally mature, and is really coming to terms with a lot of stuff for the first time. And she's thrust into a situation with a person who is very much like her, who is extremely stubborn, is extremely smart like Seven of Nine, and is also a workaholic like Seven of Nine. But she is the captain of the ship, and Seven of Nine is not someone who... I mean, interestingly enough, Seven of Nine probably is one of the most individualistic people on the ship, because she is not subsuming her desires through the lens of being a Starfleet officer. She does not like to take orders. She defies orders. And, you know, in this episode, what's interesting to me is that when she is cut away from all of that, I think she and Janeway come to an understanding. They can rely on each other, but it's just kind of that everything else gets in their way.
Yeah, I mean, Seven of Nine doesn't understand hierarchies. That is really her. It's not that she doesn't like orders. It's not like that. But she just doesn't come from that conceptual framework. All of the Borg are equal. Now, I know there's a Borg queen, and that's going to muddy the waters. But for everything I know right now, any Borg is any Borg, and they're just going to kind of put it on whatever problem they need. And, you know, in a way, a Borg can make a decision, and that filters through the collective, and that's how the collective moves. To have Janeway and Seven of Nine working laterally aside each other to solve a problem, Seven of Nine understands that. She is used to being with people equally or greater capable than herself and, you know, attacking a problem. She's not used to an order coming through.
Yeah, I think that's right. And to move aside from that and to go back to the other thing I want to talk about, because we should move on to Vis-a-Vis in a minute, but the Hirogen stuff, I mean, I think that we were maybe a little unfair to it. I think that that comparison between the Hirogen and World War II, I think, is interesting. And if it had been teased out more throughout the two-parter, I think it would have been very strong. As it is, it almost reads to me like Joe Manosky and Brannon Braga flailing around to come up with some sort of Star Trekian message at the end of this episode to wrap it up, you know?
Yeah.
And like, I feel like it would have been a lot better if that had been seeded through the entire two-parter, if that was sort of an explicit or even an implicit assumption on the show's part.
They're trying to do that, you know, a little bit, and this is more maybe in retrospect, but there are all these moments where the head one is like, you know, where the second in command is like, let's kill everybody, and the one, in, you know, his commander's like, no, we can't do that. You're right. I'm going to follow your orders. And, you know, of course, there is, you know, all of us, you know, we need to hunt, you know, hunting is what defines us. I mean, I guess it approaches the eventual revelation and the ultimate philosophy of the episode, but you're right, it could have been done stronger and to more of a point.
Yeah, yeah.
Because this episode does kind of go towards the, you know, well, the Hirogens are like the Nazis, and Borg are like the Nazis, and everyone bad is like the Nazis, and it in a way kind of dilutes things, but...
Yeah, that could be. But I mean, I do think that one of the strongest scenes in the entire two-parter was the scene where the fake Nazi is giving that impassioned speech about the purity of German blood and how they need to wipe the, you know, Jews and everybody else off the face of the earth, and the Hirogens is like totally buying into it, which is... I really wish that scene had leaned a little more into the creepy aspect of that and sort of the unreality of it, because the Hirogen is getting sucked into the garbage philosophy of a fake Nazi of a species that, you know, he's not related to in any way, shape, or form, that happened, you know, 500 years ago at this point. And I that scene is really, really well done. It's really well written and really well acted. But one of the things I always wonder about it was, did Joe Manosky and Brannon Braga intend the Hirogen to come across as weak-minded as he comes across in that scene where he's being talked into? I mean, I guess the implication is that the Hirogen wanted to do this, and so anybody could have talked him into doing it, but I don't know that comes across enough.
Again, it seems like throughout the episodes, you know, the Hirogen is kind of on the doorstep of mutiny and, you know, countermanding his orders and deciding that the will to hunt, you know, but not quite there and just needing a rousing speech to kind of clarify things. But, and let's face it, anybody who can hear a speech and, you know, from a fictional character and decide, let's become, like, you know, Nazis about this, is pretty weak-minded. And I say that because I know there are people who have, you know, gotten to that point and they are weak-minded, but that's a different story. It's the kind of thing where you almost get the sense that they don't rec— you know, this is an episode that was written 20 years before actual Nazis came into power in the U.S., and so I think they kind of think of the idea as solved and ludicrous, you know?
True, yeah. Yeah, I think that's right. Well, we could get on a road of talking about Nazis, but maybe we should wrap this this conversation up and move on to Vis-a-Vis. Before we do that, I do want to take an opportunity to remind all of you that this podcast is listener supported. We thank each and every one of you that give us money each and every month. If you would like to be in that exclusive club, please go to patreon.com/truckaboutshow, check out our reward tiers, and give. Thank you very much. Now let's talk about Vis-a-Vis. And we just talked about Vis-a-Vis.
Thank you for listening to episode 275 of Trek About. We appreciate your...
This is episode 289, by the way.
Oh my god. just answer me straight out. Is Paris on another secret mission and that's why he's being surly? Just tell me.
No.
Okay, so they're just, you know, remember that at one point Paris was surly and we're going to go with that?
Uh-huh.
Listen, the thing is, there is a perfectly explicable explanation for Paris being in a weird mood these past few weeks. It's something that the showrunners know because they spent a lot of time on it. A couple weeks ago, Paris got a letter or didn't from his father, and he's been stewing and mulling it over. He has had a moment of soul searching. Why is there not a line in this episode like where B'Elanna's all, why have you been acting this way ever since the letter from your father? Okay, I understand. Like, I feel like that would have made this episode make a lot more sense, because otherwise it's just Paris is being an asshole out of nowhere.
Well, he didn't get the letter.
No, I know. But the point is, he knows his father wrote to him. I think that's enough, to, you know, given Paris's history with his father, I think that's enough to trigger a bunch of soul searching in him.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a good read. And I think that if you want to go back in time 20 years and get hired on the writing staff of Star Trek Voyager, you would probably do a much better job than this guy.
And a lot of people would listen to our podcast because it's done by a former Voyager writer.
Absolutely. You know, I kind of agree with you. I mean, I think that I struggle with this episode because, like The Killing Game Part 2, it's entertaining, it's interesting, it moves at a fast pace, they know what they're doing. But it really speaks to a lack of interest in developing the secondary characters in this show. You know, I think that we are starting to get to the point where the criticism of Star Trek Voyager as not really having a lot of well-developed characters is coming out, because I don't think that was true for a while. I don't think that was true for the first three seasons of the show, frankly. I mean, certainly the characters perhaps were not as well drawn as the ones in TNG, but I think that they were well drawn enough. And I've made the point that a lot of the characters in TNG were not as well crafted as people think they were. And it's just by dint of the fact that the actors were better or whatever.
Yeah, no, but the thing is, you have the TNG characters evolving over time, maybe not as drastic of changes as the characters in DS9. You know, did, but Picard at the end is different than he was at the beginning. Part of that is, again, due to Patrick Stewart figuring out the character better, but part of that is due to Patrick Stewart figuring out the character better and certain changes that they make as the as time goes on. And I think Voyager's characters maybe start off a little ahead than where TNG's characters start, but they kind of stagnated there. You know, we have characterization that is fine for a season two, but we're on season 4 or 5 now.
Yeah, because I mean,
still don't know what season we are in.
Season 4. That's a bad sign. If you took out the B'Elanna and Tom Paris subplot, if you took that out entirely, this could have very easily have been a season 2 episode. And I don't think that that's complimentary to the show. I mean, part of the issue that I have with this episode is that it places Tom Paris in a place that he hasn't been in a while. And even to the point of the entire arc of Tom Paris is pretending to be a fuck up in order to flesh out the person who's, you know, giving information to the Kazon was itself a repudiation of the idea that Tom Paris was still kind of a fuck up. He had gotten his act together enough to pretend to be a fuck up in the second season of the show over 2 years ago. You know, Tom Paris is a different person than he was in the beginning of this show's run. And for whatever reason, this show throws that out. And I think it's very lazy.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost like this was an episode that was held over from that arc and, you know, that they decided to write in now. And, oh, yeah, we got to add B'Elanna in there because now she's a thing. I mean, I don't know if that's the case or not, but you're right. It does seem like this is an episode which comes from an earlier part in his life. We need to buy that maybe Tom Paris wants to leave Starfleet or has might be satisfied in some way by, you know, leaving the ship. We can fully understand that, yes, there is no way he's actually going to leave. But I think we don't even have that doubt anymore. And this episode kind of hinges on, like, that 1% of doubt.
I think so. And I think that, for me, what it comes down to with this episode is that it seems to want to argue that where this is coming from is perhaps not that Tom Paris has, I don't know, like gone back, regressed 2 years or something, but that he is feeling the weight of, like, he can handle being a good Starfleet officer and he can handle showing up for his duty shifts on time. But the loss of Cass and him having to step up and get trained as a medical professional, which he has no interest in, and then also being in this relationship with B'Elanna that is getting more and more serious, and she is placing more demands on his time and things of that nature. You know, to some degree, I think this episode is it's trying to do that, but it's just not doing it very competently, you know. And I don't know if that's the fault of Robert Duncan McNeil. I don't know if that's the fault of the writing, you know. I don't know, but there's just something about it which I can see where the germ of this idea came from. I can see how Tom Paris could act like this, but the episode doesn't do enough with it to make me actually think that that is the reason. I think that's what a lot of the problem with the episodes of Voyager that we criticize pretty heavily is that this is a show that tells and doesn't show.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to put it. I mean, they're trying to make it seem like, yes, Paris is not somebody who's going to shy away from a challenge. At the beginning, when he has to, you know, fly this ship to disable the other ship, like, that's a challenge, and he gleefully does it. And, you know, the unfortunate thing for Paris right now is that the challenges that are being placed in front of him are maybe not ones that he will quite excel in to the same degree that he will an engineering or a piloting challenge. You know, he's just not going to earn that much XP in the medical field, you know, based on how much time he spends there.
Right. And I think that, I mean, for example, I'm not really ever sure why Tom Paris doesn't just go to Chakotay or Janeway and say, I don't really want to do this. I will do it if you really think it's necessary, but
I think he's,
I don't really have any aptitude for this. I understand that I have some basic first aid training, but a lot of people on this ship had basic first aid training. Is there anyone else that could do this besides me?
Yeah, no, it's true. Like, I think he was initially picked prior to Kes just because he was the closest person near them, but, you know, then they found Kes, and again, in that entire time, the doctor only trained Kes. You would think that he would train some other people would be other people on the ship who were not necessarily directly in the medical field, but had a knack for it and an interest. Tom Paris makes it clear to literally everybody he meets, ugh, I have to go to sick bay later. How horrible is it? Have you ever been to sick bay? It's awful. I mean, he complains about it a lot. Maybe he hasn't directly gone to Janeway, but she knows.
But he complains about everything, though. I mean, that's kind of who Tom Paris is. He's a complainer.
So maybe, like, no one is taking him seriously because, you know, he is going to do the sick bay stuff. I mean, he is doing it, at least. I mean, give him that credit, but I don't know. Maybe if he actually did get taken out of sick bay, he'd miss it. He might be that asshole.
Well, I don't know. I don't think so, because, I mean, he's playing hooky from sick bay, and he's not showing up for his duty shifts, and he's working on this holographic car. But, I mean, I don't think he would. I mean, maybe he would, but that doesn't seem to be where he wants to be, and especially for someone who has a lot of demands on his time. I mean, he has full duty shifts on the bridge. He's the pilot of the ship. He's a senior officer for some reason. And he also has a girlfriend, and they're getting increasingly serious, and she's pregnant, even though no one knows she's pregnant. I'm kidding. She's not actually pregnant. Roxanne Dawson is pregnant.
I have this theory, though.
Theory.
That, again, they're going to, it's going to be obviously pregnant, and everybody's going to be like, oh, well, Roxanne Dawson's pregnant, but it was secretly B'Elanna, and that's going to be a plot twist.
Again, I don't think you understand how pregnancy works. but then the other part of it that I don't know that I like is how Tom and B'Elanna's relationship is portrayed in this episode. I mean, I think B'Elanna comes across very well. I think she comes across like sober, serious minded. She's hurt, but she's communicating well. Tom Paris is acting like a fucking child. And I don't know why she puts up with this, honestly, but why? Like, why do we need to see this? I just keep saying to myself, like, what is Star Trek Voyager missing? Is it missing by the numbers heterosexual relationship drama? Is that what it's missing?
I don't know. Well, we did get a comment on our blog, and somebody, when we were, I think, talking about Tom and B'Elanna getting together initially, and I think the comment basically said, you guys might just be a little too far from Breeder Town to get this, and it's possible that, like, this is a lovely romance thing that every straight couple goes through, and we just cannot see the beauty of this Tom and B'Elanna plot.
Look, on behalf of all queer people everywhere, straight people, I just want to apologize for you, because life does not have to be like this, but anyway...
I mean, I think that she doesn't put up with it for most of the episode. I mean, she is getting to, another few days of this, and I don't think that they would be together anymore. You get that sense. You get she obviously knows something is up with him. He's welcome to talk to his girlfriend about it if he wants, but he's not, and so she's going to put up with him a bit because, again, she understands him pretty well. She knows he's just probably in a mood and will snap out of it, but I think her patience is wearing thin on this. She's given him as much leeway as he deserves by the end.
Yeah, and I mean, I think the other thing, I mean, I think that's right, and I certainly think, like I said before, B'Elanna comes across in this episode much more mature and much better than Tom Paris does, for sure. Tom Paris does not come across well in this episode at all, but the other part of it that I always struggle with is this episode in particular seems to have a very sort of like conservative view of what it means to be a responsible adult.
Yeah.
And I mean, you can still like have fun and do weird things and have adventures and be a responsible adult. And this episode seems to be making the very bizarre argument that Tom Paris is a sober, mature adult who goes back to his suburban ranch house every night and watches television and, plays with his kids and then goes to bed and goes to work in the morning. And like, that doesn't make any sense to me fundamentally.
Well, you don't watch heterosexual comedies that often. That would be, there is, I mean, you've just described every slacker romantic comedy ever. You have all the fun with your friends, but then you finally meet the girl and you settle down and, if things are a little less crazy, you've grown up a bit. And then you go to Vegas and then you come back.
But that's not what I want from Star Trek. Like, I know. It's really boring,
Listen, it was the 90s. They had to, reedify gender roles or something like that. Bush was about to be elected.
I guess, but why? I mean, why? Why? Like, no. Fundamentally speaking, why?
It's true. I like the idea of having two major characters, navigate a relationship in an unusual circumstance. Starfleet is certainly an unusual circumstance. Voyager is. Okay, fine, but what are we getting from the drama? What are people supposed to be getting from the drama? Again, is it just that this is entertaining and we don't get it? Is this entertaining? Do people get entertained by this?
I can't see how it would be.
Yeah, I mean, we watched Bear City and we got entertained by that. So, you know, it might just be a straight thing.
It might be. I mean, it might just be too divorced from it to get it. But I don't. I mean, I fundamentally look at this and I say, B'Elanna deserves better than Tom Paris.
Yeah.
I mean, Tom Paris seems fine. He seems like the kind of guy that's going to show up 3 hours late to your date with a puppy that he just bought. I mean, you know, fine, whatever. But, you know, like unreliable charming assholes are fun for a while. I think that's true regardless of what,
yeah,
you know, your sexuality is. But at a certain point, you just get tired of it. And I mean, Tom Paris is, and the episode has this very weird dichotomy about who Tom Paris is. And he is like, he's been okay for a long time, and then all of a sudden, because he has like a hot girlfriend, he's going to start disappearing again. I don't get it. I don't get what this episode is trying to do at all.
Yeah, no, Tom Paris is the kind of guy that's amazing to have a fling with, and you know it's not going to be a serious future, not going to move in together, but you're going to have a lot of fun. And this episode is trying to deal with Tom Paris being the guy that, you know, settles down with his, you know, intelligent, beautiful girlfriend that, you know, likes him for some reason. And he's going to have his one job that he excels at, and he's going to have his little hobby. And, you know, this episode is basically trying to be Tom Paris is deciding between the suburbs and the city. And I don't know. I don't know where Tom Paris, I don't know who Tom Paris is. I guess that's it.
Yeah, I don't know either, and I don't think the show knows. And what makes it even weirder is we haven't even talked about like the actual plot of the episode, which is this like weird DNA thief or something who like steals the identities of all these people and then gets bored with them. And you know, the scenes of Steth as Tom Paris realizing that like Tom Paris's life is kind of boring are interesting, and that as we're talking about Tom Paris as a fuck up, as we're talking about Tom Paris as someone who is chafing against the expectations that he is living with, like his actual day-to-day life is pretty boring, is pretty structured. You know, he goes to work, he goes to his girlfriend, he might hide out in the holodeck a little bit, but what's he doing in the holodeck? He's not doing anything weird. He's not having like all the holographic orgies. He's not murdering people. He's just building a car. And I think that when Steth is walking around and realizing that Tom Paris's life is pretty boring and Tom Paris is the other guy and has to get his body back and is realizing that he actually wants to get his life back, I mean, that's all a fine structure for an episode, but it's nothing more than that.
A few weeks ago, we talked about the X-Files episode Small Potatoes, in which there is a shapeshifter who takes over Mulder's life at one point. And, you know, this reminded me very much because it's him going through his day-to-day and, you know, realizing that the life is much more unfulfilling on the inside than it appears to be on the outside. And, you know, yet part of the implication of the X-Files episode was that Mulder has actively chosen this life, and he has decided that, you know, certain trade-offs may or may not have been worth it in order to, you know, pursue his true goals. So I guess for vis-a-vis to work, for the emotional core of it to make sense, we have to see Tom Paris's life as experienced by this outsider alien character and decide that, you know, Paris has made the most of his situation and has come to love these aspects of his life. And I'm not sure if he entirely, it's not like the episode ends with Paris 100% deciding, I love everything in my life and this is great. It also doesn't end with him deciding to change. I mean, I guess he just figures I'm going to appreciate what I've got more. And that's not,
I mean, he does take B'Elanna to the garage. That's nice, I suppose.
Yeah, recognizing that, you know, he does need to I mean, but that's the other lesson that the two of them always had, you know? We can open up to each other. We should open up to each other. We are two people in a relationship. When one of us is dealing with a thing, we talk about it. You know, he does explicitly say he's showing her this car as his symbolic way of, you know, acknowledging to her that he needs to be more open and let her in a way.
Yeah, yeah. No, I agree with that. All right, well, I think we've said all we can say about The Killing Game Part 2 and Vis-a-Vis. If you have any thoughts on either of these episodes, please leave a comment on the post for this episode of the podcast at truckaboutshow.com. You can check out our Patreon. Patreon.com/truckaboutshow is the place you can go to give us a little bit of your money each month. It also supports our other podcast, Tuning In, which Richard gave us a little plug earlier for. You can check that out at tuninginshow.com. We are talking about the season 5 premiere of The X-Files in 2 days this week. Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, we are there. Truck About Show is our username in all those places. And as always, please leave us an Apple Podcast iTunes review for Truck About. Believe it or not, it really does help. Next week, we are going to be talking about The Omega Directive and Unforgettable.